This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Bring the Noise, the Jurgen Klopp story. Written by Raphael Honigstein. Read by Adam James.
It ain't where you from, it's where you at. Eric B. and Ricky. Chapter 1, The Surprise. Glatton, 1967. The Black Forest isn't black. Not even a forest. Not anymore. 1800 years ago, the wild Germanic tribes of the Almani first tore through the massed gloom that had so scared the Romans to make space for cattle and villages. Celtic missionaries from Scotland and Ireland, armed with axes and faith, kept pushing inward until nature was bested, iniquity contained. Today, the remnants of the darkness mostly serve as raw material for children's nightmares and cuckoo clocks, as well as a magnificent tourism brand. From all over the country and beyond, they flocked to the low mountain range in Germany's southwesterly corner to clear their lungs and hearts of all urban squalor. After the war, the Black Forest became a favourite of a film industry searching for an unsoiled backdrop, an idyllic setting for health clinics, real and imagined. One of those places where fantasy and reality could blend into one another to enchanting effect. Cynics beware, because it is, of course, all true, in the picture-perfect town of Glatton. The neat white houses with their gingerbread rooftops and wooden balconies, unpretentiously pushed up against the hills, keeping watch over endless slopes of green. Others build on top of the hill to show off their splendour, but Swabians build their houses into the hill to hide how big they truly are, explains former Green Party politician Rezo Schlausch about the modest mindset of the local inhabitants, his kinsmen. They will keep the Mercedes in the garage and put the VW in the driveway. The River Glatt, Old High German for bright or smooth, flows down from the north into the tiny town that borrowed its name past the steel-clad J. Schmaltz GmbH vacuum technology factory. The river is a discreet chaperone to the high street, car dealership, bank, bakery, butcher, florist, a doner kebab stand, and hesitant supplier to the natural swimming pool, flowing out again next to the sports ground past Boffingen, a village that's been absorbed by Glatton proper. A difficult climate. There's a lot of rain. Makes this a paradise won, not given. They grow grass, corn, piglets, and people of fearsome resolve and frugality here. An extreme type of Germans. Harder than the hard-working. Unwilling to give themselves an inch. Schaffe, schaffe, Hausel bau. You work, work, then build a house. That's how the famous saying in this region goes. To toil day and night is a big part of being Swabian, says Schlausch. That has its roots in history, as has the Swabians' reputation for being innovative. In other regions, the firstborn would inherit their parents' farms. But in Swabia, the land was partitioned equitably among the children. The farmland got smaller and smaller until it was no longer viable, so the descendants were forced to take up other jobs. Many of them became inventors and Tüftler, people looking to find new solutions to old problems. Local custom demands that everything must be done studiously, seriously, including fun. One of the 14 active social clubs in Glatton is dedicated to carnival. Another one brings together friends of the German shepherd dog. Barnsline, a little street dotted with lumps of clay left behind by tractors. And then it's here, right next to a field, is Old Reich's Haarstubel, a petite hair salon, discreet meeting place, outlet for charity socks hand-knitted by one of Reich's friends. The proceeds go towards buying shoes for the homeless. Isolde was born in Glatton in 1962, the younger of two sisters. Her father Norbert, a talented goalkeeper, was a sport fanatic. Thwarted by a serious-minded father, he insisted Norbert should have a proper vocation, not try his hand at becoming a football pro, Reich says. His career was over before it had really begun. His sporting ambitions, however, were undiminished. He played amateur football, handball and tennis, and tried to pass on his passion to his family. When his wife Elizabeth and eldest daughter Stephanie showed no inclination to take up any game, Norbert's hopes centred on Isolde. Before her birth, in my album of baby photos, he wrote, "Isolde, you should have been a boy, actually," she smiles. And after, "I was the first girl in all of Glatton to go to football training." Norbert was her coach, his methods exacting and demanding. He took 5-year-old Isolde to practice heading on the Ried Weissen football pitch next to the river, where an old heavy ball on a rope hung from a green iron bar. If her body positioning wasn't right, or her arms were too high, Norbert sent her to run a lap around the pitch for punishment. He was tough, but just, a man of principle, full of passion, Reich says. In the summer of 1967, her mother left the family home for a month. Elizabeth was heavily pregnant, and the risk of complications made it necessary to check into a clinic in Stuttgart, 80 minutes away to the northwest. The local hospital at Freudenstadt, just 8.5 kilometres up the road, wasn't equipped to perform cesareans. It was hard for Stephanie and Isolde to be without their mother for such a long time. "We were promised. Mum will bring something amazing for you when she comes back." When Norbert and Elizabeth arrived at the house, however, they had a tiny baby in their arms, screaming its head off. After an hour or so, the sisters wondered whether it could be taken back and exchanged for something different. A small, shrieking brother. What a lousy surprise. But Isolde soon realized that she'd be given much more than a second, annoyingly loud sibling that day. "All my dad's sporting focus shifted immediately onto the boy. I was relieved from practicing headers with the pendulum, allowed to take up ballet and athletics instead. Jürgen's birth was my good fortune, really. He set me free." Chapter 2. Rose Monday, 0 hour. Mainz, 2001. Christian Heidel loves the story so much, he's beginning to wonder if it's actually true. "As a Mainzer, I could say, let's make this up. But it really happened," he insists, readying himself for a mental hyperjump. From the corporate blandness of his Schalke 04 office to a city lustily singing and dancing in a confetti rain and a tiny, hopeless second division team banished to a distinctly unsexy provincial exile 40 minutes away by car. The day before, on 25th of February 2001, FSV Mainz 05 had played their bogey side SPV GG Grutter Firth and had lost 3-1 at the Playmobil Stadion. Klopp was a little bit injured and the worst man on the pitch. He had to come off 20 minutes before the end, Heidel says. The defeat plunged Mainz deep into the relegation zone. "We were am Arsch," the former FSV general manager smiles. "Quite literally in the bottom of the table, with no discernible light at the end of the tunnel. We had 3,000 people at games on average. Nobody cared about us anymore. Everybody was sure we were going down." His colleagues on the Mainz board were all in the city centre, revelling in the Rose Monday carnival festivities, for which the capital of Rhineland Palatinate is famous in Germany. 500,000 people dress up in silly costumes and get a little tipsy and a little flirty. State broadcasters ARD and ZDF devote an entire evening to the 4-hour meeting of the city's carnival clubs at the Electoral Palace, a potpourri of beer-soaked gags and political satire. Eckhard Krautzen, the well-travelled Mainz coach, nicknamed Wertelbummler, Globetrotter, deemed the temptations of the carnival too great for the team ahead of a very big game at Duisburg on Ash Wednesday. After losing at Firth, the shit had hit the fan in Mainz. We knew that they would either axe the coach or set light to our backsides. We were secluded in a hotel in Bad Kreuznach for 3 days so that no one got out and about, says FSV midfielder Jürgen Kramny, Jürgen Klopp's roommate at the time. Christian Heidel had stayed at home in Mainz. He wasn't in the mood for partying. The team's situation was too dire to act the fool. It was obvious that the coach had to go. Krautzen was a very pleasant man, no doubt, an experienced operator who'd once coached Diego Maradona in a game for El Ahly FC in Saudi Arabia, the national teams of Kenya and Canada, as well as a raft of clubs around the world. But 6 points in 9 games since he had taken over in November was the kind of run that was heading straight for relegation. Heidel also felt that Krautzen had somewhat tricked him into getting appointed in the first place. His predecessor, the former Belgian international René van der Rijken, had been a gruff, monosyllabic coach whose refusal to communicate with players, board members and officials was matched only by his reluctance to put forward a coherent playing system. He was fired 12 games and a meagre 12 points into the 2000-2001 season, with Mainz in the relegation zone once more. Heidel wanted someone in charge next who could re-implement the successful back-four zonal marking system that the former Mainz coach Wolfgang Frank had introduced 6 years earlier, a tactic seen as so modern and advanced at the time by Bundesliga standards that almost no one knew how to make it work. Heidel: I told everybody that I wanted a coach with a sense of understanding of a back-four, somebody who could practice it, who could teach the players. All of a sudden, I get a call from Crouzen. I have to be honest, I hadn't thought of him at all. He'd been at Kaiserslautern before, it hadn't really worked out for him there, and I had the feeling there was no point. But he kept on talking and talking until he convinced me to meet him. So I went to see him in Wiesbaden. He proceeded to explain everything about the back four in great detail to me, and I thought, fuck me, he really does know his stuff after all. I'd seen so much of Frank's training that I knew exactly what the specific exercises had looked like. So I appointed him coach. About 2 weeks later, Klopp came up to me and said that Crouzen had called him a month before. He wanted to know how the back four works. We spoke for 3 hours. And that's what it looked like on the pitch. We won one game in the beginning, and then it all went tits up. Getting rid of Crouzen was the sensible, easy decision. Finding the right successor proved much harder. Heidel tore through a mountain of kicker yearbooks, hoping to excavate a suitable candidate. There was no World Wide Web then. You didn't know who coached at Brugge, for example. In any case, these types of teams were 5 times our size. Different times. There were almost no foreign coaches in the Bundesliga either. You were fishing in the same pond the whole time. After a while, Heidel closed all the books and admitted defeat. I thought the only chance left for us was to somehow get to the point where we played like we had under Wolfgang Frank. But I couldn't find anyone. I had no idea who could do this job. Maybe Heidel found inspiration in the jesters parading through the Mainz streets on the day when normal rules didn't apply. He was out of sensible answers. The only logical move left was to plump for the downright absurd. If there was no right coach to be found, maybe the answer was to go without one? I thought, let's do something spectacular. We should coach ourselves. There were enough really good guys and intelligent players in the squad, he says, to make that crazy idea work. They could teach those who had arrived after Frank's time at the Braunschweig Stadion. But football being football, somebody still had to be in charge. Heidel chewed over putting himself up. I could have told them how the system works after attending so many of Wolfgang's sessions, but I'd never played a single game in the Bundesliga, not even in the Oberliga, fourth division. That would have looked stupid. That's why I gave Klopp a call in his hotel room in Bad Kreuznach. He had no clue what was coming. Heidel informed the veteran right-back that they couldn't carry on with Crouzen, that they had to make a change. I said to him, I think you are uncoachable. The stuff we play here or want to play to be successful, nobody in Germany understands. You, the team, understand it, but it doesn't work out with any of the coaches. Klopp still didn't know what I was getting at. Then I said, what do you think about us coaching ourselves? Someone has to front it, and that should be you. There was a silence on the other side of the line for maybe 3-4 seconds. Then he said, great idea. Let's do it. Heidel called Captain Dimo Vacca, the goalkeeper. Kloppo was the real captain, but Dimo had the armband. Dietmar Constantini, the coach prior to Crouzen, had taken it off Klopp because he'd always complained about tactics. He was into tactics unlike any other player. He spent a lot of time thinking about it. Constantini had also taken him out of the team for a spell. Kloppo on the bench, that doesn't work at all. It's funny when he complains about players complaining today. You should have seen him then. Harald Strutz, the debonair Mainz president, was busy fulfilling carnivalistic duties as a leading member of the Ranzengarde, a 19th century guard of faux soldiers mocking Prussian militarism. Heidel called me and said, we have to sack the manager urgently. Strutz says, sitting in his neat office in Mainz's administrative headquarters in a corporate block outside the city. In the lobby, there's a glass cabinet with FSV merchandise, including a special version of Monopoly with Klopp and Heidel on the cover. Crouzen was very proper. He wanted to stay in the job, but we told him it's over. So I took off my Ranzengarde uniform and drove back to Bad Kreuznach. Everyone's partying on Rose Monday in Mainz, but that doesn't mean everyone's drunk. Well, I wasn't. Otherwise, I wouldn't have driven there. We asked Kloppo, do you think you're up to it? He didn't hesitate for a second. Yes, absolutely. Yes, of course. Strutz pauses for a moment, taken aback by the incongruity of the most important decision he's ever presided over at Mainz. He's a local politician for the Liberal Democrats and works as a lawyer. There's a copy of the Bürgerliches Gesetzbuch, the German Civil Code, on his conference table. Strutz is, in summary, a pretty serious man. Not the kind of club boss you'd expect to get swept up by the schnapsity, flight of fancy, of his general manager. It's a very special story, he continues. That was the beginning. Why should we change that? If you knew what it looked like here, then, it was an extraordinary achievement to keep the whole team together. An extraordinary start to such a coaching career. This extraordinary still fizzes in the mind. The 10 local journalists who arrived for the FSV press conference at Bad Kreuznach the next day weren't as elated. Heidel. They already knew that Krautzen was gone. We confirmed it. Then this one journalist, Reinhard Rehberg, who still works today, said, "What is Klopp doing here?" They all thought we would appoint the assistant coach as caretaker manager, but I didn't think we even had an assistant manager at the time. So I said, "Kloppo will be the coach here." The whole table roared with laughter. They all cracked up. They took the piss out of us the next day in the papers. People believe that everybody cheers Klopp all the time, but he wasn't the Klopp of today. He was the Klopp of then. He was a player. He didn't have a professional coaching badge. He had studied sports science. Klopp knew that the reporters didn't believe he was in any way qualified to save Mainz from the drop. He made a joke about his own inexperience, pretending he didn't know the script. "You have to tell me what I have to say here," he commanded the press corps with a broad smile. "The next thing, I'll never forget this," Heidel says. The journalist left and Klopp said, "We're off to train now." We boarded a couple of buses and drove to Friedrich Moibus Stadion. And I got there and I saw something that made me think, ah, there's life here. There were these poles on the pitch everywhere. The team were practicing moving side to side in formation again. That's when I knew we had returned to the times of Wolfgang Frank. The squad were as surprised as the journalists that Klopp was the new boss. All of a sudden, there's Klopper in the meeting room addressing us as coach, former SFV midfielder Sandra Schwartz remembers. He was still one of us, really. You didn't have to address him formally or keep your distance. He had a natural authority, but we were still close, and he followed through on things. The team didn't mind because we were in such difficulties in the relegation fight. Nobody believed in us anymore. The boys who had been there for a while longed to play the 4-4-2 system again, the system that had made us strong. With his positive demeanour, he got us to adopt the old behavioural patterns once more. The first ever team meeting left a lasting impression on Heidel. I still remember how that room looked. This guy had never addressed a team before, never. I was a bit leaner then, fitter. If somebody had given me a pair of boots right then, I'd have dashed out to play against Duisburg after hearing him talk. I'd witnessed 10, 11 coaches before, but nothing like that. You wanted to go out and play straight away. I left the room and encountered many doubters. They said, "He's only a player." I told Strutz and my colleagues on the board that we would win, 100%. If the team were as sure as I was, we had to win. We would win. I can't tell you the exact words, but it was a mixture of tactics and motivation, more of a lecture. We could have played immediately. He talked and talked until the team believed they were good. Taking the job felt like a kamikaze mission, Klopp admitted to Spox.com a decade later. There was only one question I asked myself. What can we do to stop losing? I didn't think about winning the game at all. The first session was all about running across the pitch tactically. I put up these poles and wondered what the right distances between the lines had been under Wolfgang Frank. Most players still had the right moves lodged in their long-term memory from the days they'd practiced it under him until they'd been blue in the face. We wanted to play a game that was independent of the opposition. As far as the motivational part of this pep talk was concerned, it too echoed one of Frank's themes, that investing the final 5%, Klopp, would make the difference. Klopp made simple decisions, Cramley says. I moved from right midfield into the centre. One or two more changes. Heidel told us that we all had to pull together after giving previous coaches such a hard time. We all felt responsible. There wasn't much time to do a lot, so the idea was to inject a bit of fun, to practice our shape and dead balls. And then we said, okay, let's go. Run, run, run. It was pissing down on match day. Heidel. There were 4,500 people in the ground. Playing on Ash Wednesday is something special in Mainz. Duisburg were much the better side, a hot contender for promotion. I have to honestly say we played them off the park. We won 1-0, but they never got near our goal. They couldn't deal with our system at all. The people in the stadium went berserk. Those in the main stand had a particularly good time. They saw Mainz coach behaving like the 12th man, effectively playing the game on the touchline, Heidel adds. The stand only held 1,000 people at the time, but they were in stitches laughing about the guy down below. I didn't even know where he ran to when we scored. Maybe he was even sent off by the referee. He wasn't on this occasion. It was all very, very special. But you have to say this. That was his birth. And then he was on his way. Chapter 3. Revolution 09. Dortmund 2008. It's a sharp winter's night in Marbella in January 2017, and the Don Pepe Gran Melea Hotel lobby is a dynasty set designer's dream. White marble, gold-cased pillars, potted palm trees, and a man playing the saxophone. Borussia Dortmund staffers in shorts are pushing crates of dirty apparel from the evening's training session past the vacant hotel bar. Sitting on a cream-coloured sofa, Hans-Joachim Watzke takes in the scene with a contented nod. The 58-year-old BVB CEO is a successful entrepreneur. His workwear company, Vatex, turns over 250 million euros annually. He's the man who saved the club from bankruptcy in 2005, the man who brought back the good football, the excitement, and the trophies to the Westfalenstadion by hiring Jurgen Klopp in 2008. But, like any true supporter, he seems to find the most happiness and pride in just being here, on a 10-day winter break to Andalusia with the team. He's wearing a training suit with his initials on the chest. Why Klopp? It's an easy question to answer, he says, setting down his espresso cup. In 2007, it was clear that we would survive as a club, but also clear that we had no money to put into the team. Ballspieler in Borussia 09E versus Dortmund Bundesliga champions in 1995 and 1996. Champions League winners in 1997 and champions again in 2002 had done a Leeds, a cash injection of 130 million euros from floating the club on the Frankfurt Stock Exchange in 2000 had been spent on hugely expensive players in an unsustainable arms race with Bayern Munich. When the team failed to qualify for the Champions League in 2005 for the second time in a row, the club almost collapsed under the weight of the 240 million euro worth of debt. We were at the club HQ and didn't know whether we would still have a job the next day, stadium announcer and former BVB striker Norbert Nobby Dickel says. Awful times. Dortmund is a city that lives with the club, that lives for the club, Sebastian Kiel says. The former captain remembers the whole town being on edge, extremely worried that Borussia could be wound up. Taxi drivers, bakers, hotel employees, everybody feared for their livelihood. It was very tough to deal with for us players, knowing that winning or losing won't make much of a difference. It was Watzke, the former treasurer of the club, not the PLC, who saved BVB by wresting control from the quite literally discredited duo of sporting director Michael Mayer and president Gerd Neubaum. He negotiated a loan from Morgan Stanley and a capital increase enabling Dortmund to buy back their stadium and end a crippling leaseback arrangement. But the radical cost-cutting plan left no funds to buy star names. Watzke. Sporting director Michael Zorc and I had agreed that we wanted to build a young team. Left-back Marcel Schmelzer was already there. And midfielder Kevin Grosskreutz. We wanted to play different football as well. Under Bert van Marwijk and Thomas Doll, the ball would go from one end of the back four to the other and back again, 10 times in a row. We had 57% possession, but there was no action. You can't play like that in Dortmund. We wanted to promise people a team that ran so hard that bits would come off. That's what we'd encountered at Mainz when we played there in the prior 2 years. You always felt they weren't that good, but somehow made it very difficult for you and beat you sometimes, because they had the mentality of murderers and a very good setup tactically. That had to be down to their coach. Taking someone from the second division would have been difficult for Dortmund now, but back then it was possible. Borussia weren't entirely sure Klopp could make the transition from patron saint at Mainz to reviving a Bundesliga giant that had fallen on hard times, Christian Heidel reveals. They had concerns, he says. Watzke first approached the Mainz general manager in October 2007, ahead of the German FA annual general meeting. Heidel. He phoned and asked if we could go for a coffee. I didn't know him then. We sat down and the talk quickly turned to Jürgen Klopp. His contract was up at the end of the season. Watzke asked, how good is Klopp? I said, if I now say that he's good, you'll pinch him off me. And I could also lie and tell you that he's useless, but then you'll tell that to Kloppo and he'll be upset with me. Then I said, this guy is a Bundesliga coach. Watzke probed further, without explicitly mentioning Dortmund. Was Klopp able to coach a big Bundesliga club? I told him that Kloppo could coach any club in the world, Heidel says. That's because he's got an advantage over his peers. He's really intelligent. He will adjust at a big club. If you need someone in a suit and a tie, don't get Jürgen Klopp. But if you want a top coach, you'll have to get him. It wasn't a case of making an immediate decision, but I know that Dortmund were looking at him a bit more closely from that day on. But they still weren't entirely convinced. Watzke kept on calling me. I don't know how many times. I always said, go for it. Go for it. You will never regret the day you sign Jürgen Klopp. Regrets over the hiring of Thomas Doll were growing all the time at the Strobel Allee. The former German midfielder, in the job since March 2007, failed to inspire the players or the public with the painfully dull brand of football his team played. Dortmund were closer to relegation than to the top of the table and ended up in 13th place, their worst league position in 20 years. A good run in the DFB Pokal, where in the final in April they were beaten only by Bayern Munich in extra time 2-1, couldn't deflect from the shortcomings. Perhaps it was the most valuable final defeat in the club's history. Sascha Flieger and Franke Flieger, who wrote in Echte Liebe, a chronicle of Dortmund's comeback over the past decade. In the case of a cup triumph, the club's leadership would have had a hard time firing coach Thomas Doll, in whose qualities they'd stopped believing. Jürgen Klopp might never have gone to Dortmund. History would have taken a very different turn. The defeat in Berlin was part of the strategic plan to clear the path for Jürgen Klopp, Watzke joked later. Klopp, incidentally, had followed the match in Berlin as a TV pundit for the state broadcaster ZDF and confided in a programme editor Jan Durling that he wanted to be down there on the touchline one day. Back at their Berlin hotel, Dortmund fans were serenading him with Jürgen Klopp, you are the best man in the lobby. They wanted him to take over. Watzke says he always felt that Klopp's personality was big enough for the Herculean task. We had a sense from his TV work that he had the ability to present a big project. We didn't talk about any other manager. We only wanted Klopp. A clandestine meeting at the offices of one of Watzke's friends, not far from Mainz, brought further certainty following Doll's resignation on the 19th of May. Once the employees were all gone, we got together, says Watzke. It was a fantastic conversation. We told him our vision for the club, and it corresponded with his. Michael Zorc had gone to meet him separately the day before. We wanted to form an opinion independently of each other. We're often in agreement, but we were completely in agreement here. The chemistry was immediately very strong. Chemistry of a more synthetic kind exerted a pull on Klopp too, however. Bayer 04 Leverkusen, owned by the eponymous pharmaceutical company, had also set their eye on the coach. They didn't have the cachet of the black and yellows, but they were free from money problems, as well as possessing a decent, well-balanced squad capable of challenging for Champions League qualification. Kloppo didn't want to go to Dortmund at first. He wanted to go to Leverkusen, says Heidel. I said to him he had to go to Dortmund because of the emotions there and so on. He had a conversation with Leverkusen CEO Wolfgang Holzhauser. They couldn't make up their minds. Then Dortmund's interest grew more concrete, but Klopp wasn't sure initially. His remuneration was another sticking point, Heidel adds with a small chuckle. A funny story. Dortmund's first offer came in lower than his existing wages at Mainz in Bundesliga 2. They weren't that flash at the time. Kloppo said, "Listen, they offered me less than I'm making at Mainz." I said, "Don't worry, I'll help you." Dortmund couldn't get their head round the fact that he was making that much already. Watzke called again. "How much does he earn at yours?" "He earns good money here. He's the most important man. I'd rather save money on a player," I told him. "I don't believe it," Watzke said. They revised his salary upwards. Klopp signed a 2-year deal at Dortmund's Lenhof Hotel on the morning of Friday the 23rd of May and was unveiled at 11 a.m. at the stadium. Borussia, in truth, had more than pecuniary rewards to offer. In Josef Schneck, they employed a press officer that Klopp really liked, for starters. "We first met in April 2004 at an event in Cologne," Schneck, a kind, jovial man in his mid-60s, says. That night, Klopp was receiving a fair play award from the Association of German Sports Journalists for the way he had dealt with the heartbreaking finishes to the previous two Bundesliga 2 seasons. Matthias Sammer, the then Borussia Dortmund coach, was invited to give the laudatory speech. "We went there with Matthias and Karin, his wife, and we sat there with Klopp at the same table. It was a very nice evening," Schneck recalls. It's a touching little anecdote, considering that Sammer and Klopp would fall out spectacularly a few years later at the height of the Bayern-Dortmund rivalry. I also knew Jürgen from press conferences when Mainz had played in the Bundesliga between 2004 and 2007, Schneck continues. "Once Mainz drew 1-1 with us in Dortmund, and I congratulated him on winning a point. To draw Dortmund was a success for Mainz, wasn't it? But he just looked at me and said, 'Congratulations to you too.' That was classic Klopp. And after he came here in his first few weeks at the club, he joked to Michael Zorc, 'I couldn't decide whether or not I should sign for Dortmund, but I knew you had a decent press officer, so you can't have been too bad a club.'" What's more, few clubs can count on such fervent support. The Signal Iduna Park's famous Yellow Wall, Europe's biggest terrace, with 25,000 standing places, appealed to the "football passion that burns inside of me," Klopp told reporters at his unveiling. "Whoever has been down on the pitch here knows the Yellow Wall is something extra special. One of the most impressive things you can find in football. It's an honour for me to be the coach of BVB and to be able to get the club back into the groove. It's a wonderful story. I'm incredibly excited to get to work here." Was it a big step up for him from the Carnival Club Mainz to one of the league's traditional heavyweights? Somebody inquired. "We didn't stagger from one gala session to the next in Mainz," he smiled. "We worked with great discipline. I feel well prepared." There were rumours in the city that some of the sponsors and companies involved in Dortmund's debt restructuring had hoped for a more urbane coach, a big name with international pulling power. Klopp, perhaps aware of these misgivings, wore a jacket in the press room, but no tie. Secretly, quietly, he has worked on the gentrification of his wardrobe over the last few months, Frankfurter Allgemeine Sonntag Zeitung noted. His fiery rhetoric, however, paid homage to the working-class region's deep-rooted love of football as wild entertainment, a source of identity and a quasi-religious experience. "It's always about making the crowd happy. It's about producing games with a recognisable style," he vowed. "When matches are boring, they lose their rationale. My teams have never played chess on the pitch. I hope we will witness the odd full-throttle occasion here. The sun won't shine every day in Dortmund, but we have a chance to make it shine more often." Süddeutsche Zeitung's BVB reporter, Freddy Rockenhaus, was very impressed with so much solar-powered optimism. "If Klopp trains the team as well as he does punchlines, Dortmund will soon be ready for the Champions League," he wrote. It's only taken him 45 minutes to sweep BVB supporters off their feet with his infectious sparkle and eloquence. If ever a coach's mentality fit right into the football-mad Ruhr area, then Klopp's does. The excitement was not confined to followers of Borussia. On Klopp's personal homepage, a user stated his approval. "It's great that you're going to BVB," he wrote. "That club isn't my team at all. But I own plenty of their shares. Since I have great confidence in you and am aware of your abilities, I'm already looking forward to having more money in my pocket." The anonymous investor's trust would prove justified. Dortmund's share price rose by 132%, from 1.59 euros on the 23rd of May 2008 to 3.7 euros on the day of Klopp's departure, precisely 7 years later. Chapter 4, The Road to Anfield, 2012 to 2015. On the 11th of April, 2014, at 10 p.m, Jurgen Klopp met Hans-Joachim Watzke for a drink at Munich's Park Hilton Hotel and told him that he'd made up his mind. He was staying put. Earlier that day, ahead of the team's departure for an away game at Bayern's Allianz Arena, the Borussia Dortmund coach had still been undecided. He'd received a tempting, hugely lucrative offer from the northwest of England, a chance to take over and revolutionise one of the biggest clubs in the world. "We first met in my kitchen," says Watzke. "Without going into details, it was an interesting talk. I think it made a difference because he said to me on the plane that we needed to talk again in the evening. I was due to have dinner with my daughter, who lived in Munich, so I could only see him at 10 p.m. He straight away said, 'I can't deal with this pressure anymore. I've turned them down.'" Not long before, Manchester United Executive Vice Chairman Ed Woodward had flown out to see Klopp in Germany. David Moyes' short tenure at Old Trafford was coming to an end, and Klopp was United's favourite to replace him, to bring back a sense of adventure to the Red Devils' game. Woodward told Klopp that the Theatre of Dreams was like an adult version of Disneyland, a mythical place where, as the nickname suggested, the entertainment on show was world-class and dreams came true. Klopp wasn't entirely convinced by that sales pitch. He found it a bit unsexy, he told a friend. But he didn't dismiss the proposition out of hand either. After almost 6 years in the job at Dortmund, perhaps the time was ripe for a change of scenery. Aware of United's interest, Watzke had intended to insist that Klopp honour his contract, which had been extended to 2018 only the preceding autumn. Sensing that the 46-year-old was quite conflicted, Watzke changed tack and opted for a very risky strategy. If Klopp wanted to go to Man United, he wouldn't stand in his way, he told him, playing on their mutual trust and a connection that had long since crossed from business into the territory of friendship. After some deliberation and the conversation at Watzke's kitchen table, the BVB manager came to the conclusion that his work at the Signal in Iduna Park was not yet done. United, however, felt there was still a possibility of luring him away. When Moyes received his inevitable marching orders on the 22nd of April, Klopp was quickly installed as the bookmaker's favourite to succeed the Scot. Incessant media speculation in the UK prompted the Swabian to release a statement via The Guardian the next day to kill the rumour. "Man United is a great club, and I feel very familiar with their wonderful fans," it read. "But my commitment to Borussia Dortmund and the people is unbreakable." Klopp continued to attract interest from the Premier League regardless. 6 months after he turned down Woodward, Manchester United's local rivals, Manchester City, made an approach. Tottenham Hotspur, too, inquired about his services. At the same time, Klopp used an interview with BT Sport ahead of Dortmund's Champions League game at Arsenal to make his long-term intentions known. Asked whether he would be coming to England once his time at Borussia was over, the answer was unequivocal. "It's the only country, I think, where I should work, really, after Germany," he nodded. "Because it's the only country I know the language a little bit, and I need the language for my work. So we'll see. If somebody will call me, then we will talk about it." The writing was very much on the wall then, Watzke says. Dortmund was having their first and only poor domestic campaign with Klopp in charge, and an escape to rainier climes all of a sudden held more attraction than before. Watzke: "Our season was already in the toilet, and he got that distinct feeling. For me, it was clear that he wouldn't go anywhere else in Germany after Borussia. He wouldn't have been able to do that. He always said he didn't study English, but I'm pretty sure he polished it a little bit. I could observe that he had. It was obvious that he had to go to the Premier League. That's his game." A football romanticist, Klopp had long been an avowed fan of the real, no-holds-barred version of the sport played across the channel. At a Spanish winter training camp as Mainz coach in 2007, he had devoured Nick Hornby's fever pitch and chased a lizard around his hotel room with his toothbrush in front of a TV crew. Much of the inspiration for his brand of muscular, passionate football as well as the idea that his teams could feed off the electricity of a fanatical crowd derived from the sport's motherland. Both at Mainz and at Dortmund, the crowds belted out passable versions of You'll Never Walk Alone, conjuring up fervent atmospheres that took conscious inspiration from idealised English traditions. I like what we in Germany called Englischer Fußball. Rainy day, heavy pitch, everybody is dirty in the face, and they go home and can't play for the next 4 weeks, he said to The Guardian in 2013. That year, his young Dortmund team had gatecrashed Europe's elite competition, bursting all the way to the final of the Champions League while he was wearing a baseball cap and had the word Perle imprinted on it, Ruhr area slang for somebody playing football the old-fashioned way, on a Sunday morning, on a lawn, the basics, loving the game. Almost exactly 1 year after Klopp had said no to United, his bond with Dortmund turned out to be breakable after all. He announced he would resign at the end of the 2014-15 season, making sure to add that he didn't intend to take a sabbatical. In an Art Nouveau villa in Bremen's leafy Schwachhausen quarter, the phone started ringing a few weeks into the new Premier League season. As Brendan Rodgers' time at Anfield came to a slow, drawn-out end, a number of people contacted Klopp's agent, Mark Kursik, promising to make an introduction to Liverpool. One, a German football agent, said he knew Kenny Dalglish really well. Kursik preferred to wait. Eventually, somebody purporting to be Liverpool FC chief executive Alan Eyre called. Could they have a conversation about Klopp coming to Anfield? They could, Kursik replied, but only via a video Skype call. While Eyre hung up ahead of calling again over the app, Kursik did a quick image search of the Liverpool official, just to be sure. Too many pranksters and time wasters out there. Once you've been at Dortmund, where can you go as coach? Martin Quast, a friend of Klopp since the early 90s, asks. In Germany, there's only the national team left for Kloppo. Everything else would be a step down, even Bayern. Kloppo gets off on emotions, on empathy, on rocking the house, on being part of something really big. Compared with Dortmund, Bayern doesn't really give you that. I could only imagine him taking on a club abroad, a club like Liverpool. Christian Heidel says Klopp had only one reservation, his English. We talked about it for a long time. He asked me, should I do it? I said, the spoken word is your weapon, you know that. You have to decide if you can get across what's important in English. If you let others talk for you, it won't work. You're only 70% Klopp then. You need to be sure. And then he said, I'll manage it. I'll study now and I'll get there. And since he's very intelligent, he got there very quickly. I think at the time of LFC's approach, no other club would have stood a chance with him. He'd always been keen on them. He was excited by the emotional dimension of the job. I don't think he'd have gone to Manchester City or a club like that, even though they really wanted him. Klopp's name had first cropped up at Anfield in the spring of 2012, as possible successors to Kenny Dalglish were being sounded out. A middleman got in touch with the Dortmund coach, but was told in no uncertain terms that Klopp had no intention of leaving. He was on the way to winning a historic double. In September 2015, things got much more serious, rapidly. Brendan Rodgers' poor start to the season had prompted Boston-based Fenway Sports Group, FSG, Liverpool FC's owners, to scour the market for the next manager. We were thinking about someone who had experience and success at the highest level, FSG president Mike Gordon, 52, explains. Jürgen had done that domestically, obviously in the Bundesliga. He really had done that, apart from maybe one or two kicks in the Champions League too. I think his credentials as one of the best managers, if not the best, were apparent for all. And we liked the type of football he played, both the energy and the emphasis on attacking, high electricity, high wattage football with an appeal. So from a football sense, it was a relatively easy and straightforward decision. While there were obvious grounds for support for Klopp, as Gordon puts it, FSG's point man for Liverpool conducted due diligence on the German to see whether the hype was borne out by reality. I tried to set aside his popularity in the football world and his charisma for an unbiased analysis, says the former hedge fund manager, who started out selling popcorn at baseball games as a kid. I did a fair amount of research, along with the people inside the club, determining how he should be evaluated, purely in an analytical and football sense. The process was much the same as you would undergo in the investment business before taking a big position. I'm happy to say, and it is self-evident at this point, that however high and elevated his reputation was in the football world, the facts were actually more compelling and more persuasive still. Gordon's research pointed to Klopp having had a decidedly positive effect in a quantifiable sense relative to what you might otherwise expect on Mainz and Dortmund. Put more simply, the Swabian had outperformed. The appeal to Liverpool, whose strategy is based on a smarter use of resources in comparison with some of the more financially potent rivals in the Premier League, was clear. In a football sense, it was pretty straightforward, says Gordon. But of course, I didn't know if philosophies and personalities, that of the club and Jürgen's, would mesh. It had to be a mutual fit. We also needed to know whether Jürgen wanted to lead the football programme and project of Liverpool. Those were very important pieces that needed to be determined. A meeting was scheduled in New York on the 1st of October. Klopp's and Kosick's attempt at secrecy got off to a very bad start, however. In the Lufthansa lounge at Munich Airport, one of the staff asked Klopp, whose baseball cap didn't make for much of a disguise, why he was going to JFK. "We're watching a basketball game," he replied. A plausible explanation, except for the fact that the start of the NBA season was another 4 weeks away. An hour after their arrival in Manhattan, the two Germans were rumbled again. As luck would have it, the receptionist at the Plaza Hotel on Fifth Avenue hailed from the coach's footballing hometown. "My word, it's Kloppo!" he exclaimed in broad Mainz dialect. Somehow, news of the clandestine trip never leaked. FSG's principal owner, John W. Henry, LFC chairman Tom Werner, and Gordon met with Klopp and his agent at the offices of law firm Sherman & Sterling on Lexington Avenue, a few blocks to the east. "My first impression was that he was very tall, and I am not," Gordon laughs. "It was very late, but we had this very lengthy and substantive talk. And then we adjourned until the next day and met for more lengthy and substantive talks at the hotel. I want to emphasize, these were very much two-way conversations. This was about Jürgen being right for Liverpool FC, and Liverpool FC, us as owners, being right for Jürgen." Klopp's charisma, as suspected, was of a similar size to his frame. He uses his personal skills and his way of relating to people to get across his message. But what Gordon was struck by most was the enormity of substance he detected behind the toothy smile and supersized persona. It wasn't about, "Boy, this guy is really charming. He's going to do wonderfully at press conferences and as a representative of the club." Very quickly, what came across was his breadth of talent. Not just the personal side, but the level of intelligence. The kind of analytical thinking, the logic, the clarity and honesty. His ability to communicate so effectively, even though English was not his first language. That side, I think, he doesn't always get full credit for, because people are so taken with him as a person in the flesh. Klopp told the FSG executives that football was more than a system, that it was also rain, tackles flying in, the noise in the stadium. Most of all, he said the Anfield crowd had to be activated by the style of performance to spur on the team and vice versa in a self-amplifying cycle of exuberance. Gordon: "It was very hard to find anything that was in any way deficient, and that is the honest truth. What I'm saying is, it was clear that Jürgen, as a football manager, really was on the same level as a corporate leader or someone you would choose to run your company. I say this as someone who spent 27 years as an investor, engaging with some of the very top CEOs and leaders of business in America and Europe. At that point, it was obvious to me that he was the right person. So we decided to discuss parameters, and that's when Jürgen excused himself." While Kosick continued to discuss remuneration, Klopp walked around Central Park. The stroll would last longer than anticipated. Both sides were initially rather far apart financially, but the outline for an agreement was eventually found. After Klopp had returned to Germany, Gordon sent him a text message. "Words cannot express how excited we are," it read. In his reply, Klopp apologized that he didn't have the right vocabulary either, but he did know one word that summed up his feelings. Wow! Chapter 5. In the Game of the Father. In the summer of 1940, school was out for Norbert Klopp. His father, Karl, a hired hand at the farms and vineyards surrounding the city of Kirn in Rhineland-Palatinate, needed the 6-year-old, the only son in a family of 4 kids, to join in the work. Tending to the fertile fields of the southwest kept the Klopps alive during Germany's darkest years. The region's most famous football team, one FC Kaiserslautern, too, relied on local produce for sustenance, once the sun started to shine again in 1945. The Red Devils, whose ranks included superstar and recently released POW Fritz Walter, played dozens of friendlies against village sides in exchange for potatoes and onions. Norbert Klopp wanted to be a footballer. Who didn't? He had shot up to 1.91 metres in his teenage years and had grown into a strong, agile goalkeeper. He played for local side, VfR Kirn, one of the best clubs in the region, and his early talent was such that he was invited to trial with Kaiserslautern in 1952. "I was awestruck," the 18-year-old told family friend Ulrich Rath later. "I was on the pitch with all these legendary players." Lautern were royalty. They had won the German championship the previous season and would win it again in 1953. Four of their players, Fritz Walter, Ottmar Walter, Werner Liebrich and Werner Kollmeier, went on to lift the World Cup in Bern in 1954. Klopp, for all his talent, wasn't quite at their level. Back at VfR Kirn, who had been promoted to the regionally segmented First Division and took on the likes of Lautern and Mainz 05, he couldn't get past Alfred Hetfleisch, the number one between the posts. As Kirn's reserve goalkeeper, Klopp was briefly afforded the newly introduced Vertragsamateur, amateur under contract, status that introduced professionalism in all but name in West Germany. But monthly wages of 40 to 75 Deutschmarks made the players hugely dependent on points bonuses, between 10 and 40 Deutschmarks. Klopp had little chance to share in these. Since substitutions weren't permitted, he never made it into the lineup of the first team. He continued in the reserve team against other amateurs for the fun of it. Karl Klopp insisted the boy took on a proper job. Norbert started an apprenticeship at Müller and Mira, a manufacturer of small leather goods. About half of Kirn's population, 5,000 people, worked in the tanning and leather industry in the early 1950s, as Germany's economic miracle rapidly raised living standards. A leather craftsman earned between 250 and 300 Deutschmarks a month. It was a good job at the time, says Horst Deitz, 80, who worked in the same section as Norbert Klopp, sitting in the row behind him. A row consisted of three people, an apprentice, a gluer, often a young girl, and a craftsman. And each room had about 20 rows, supervised by a master at the front. It was piecework. One row produced up to 100 wallets or similar goods a day, working from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. with a one-hour lunch break. The loft in Dietz's house in Kirn resembles a sports pub. Framed shirts and cups from his playing days for VfR Kirn line the walls. There's a photo of him and Franz Beckenbauer, a huge screen for live football and an actual bar. He used to live in the countryside as a youngster. Klopp's family were in the town centre. Norbert would often take him home for lunch during the working week. "He was like a big brother for me. The Klopps were very well known, but they lived a normal life," says Dietz, working hard as one of their principals. If articles remained unfinished at the end of a shift, it was expected they would be completed at home. "We tried to give them to our grandmas to do, because at 14, 15, we were interested in girls and going out in the evening," he smiles. Unlike Klopp, who was 3 years his senior, he made it into Kirn's starting 11 as a striker, playing for a few years in the second division before taking on a job with Coca-Cola. "Norbert was very ambitious. He always wanted to go to the very top," Dietz recalls. "He was a daredevil, not only in sport. A charismatic guy who'd go somewhere and immediately own the room. He was full of energy and charm. A ladies' man, one might say. We often spent the whole day talking about football." In 1959, Norbert Klopp moved south to the Black Forest town of Dornen to work in the nearby Sola leather plant. He joined TSF Dornen as player-manager, playing in a variety of positions. His shots from the edge of the box were much feared, Rath says. The neatly turned-out septuagenarian, slick grey hair, lucid eyes, had been a promising footballer himself in his youth, playing for Württemberg's regional team before a treble leg break put paid to his playing career. He's now SV Glatten's honorary chairman. At a wedding in Dornen, they were public affairs then, you didn't have to have an invitation, Dietz says, Norbert Klopp met Elizabeth, Lisbeth Reich, the daughter of a brewery owner, was considered a good catch, Dietz adds. Following their wedding in the autumn of 1960, Norbert Klopp helped out in the Schwanenbrau family firm, run by his mother-in-law, Helene Reich. Elizabeth's father had come home from the war with a moving piece of shrapnel in his head and died soon after. Klopp's role at Schwanenbrau included being a Fest-Zeltsmeister, the person responsible for setting up beer tents for festivals. Elizabeth's brother, Eugen, took over the company until it closed down in 1992. In his early 30s, Klopp retrained as a merchant, taking evening lessons in nearby Freudenstadt. His new job as a sales representative for Fischer, a manufacturer of fixing systems, saw him travel all over the south of Germany during the week. Tall, smooth, and handsome, Klopp was born to be a salesperson, says Ruth. He was likable, sociable, a great entertainer who could tell the best stories. He could speak in the Swabian dialect to someone on the right and standard German to the left. Her husband, Klopp's mother Elizabeth, said he was a natural orator. He could just go. An ace rhetorical, is how Isolde Reich describes her father. Martin Kvast's father, who also hails from Kien, knew Norbert Klopp well. They played field handball together. He told me that Norbert was always at the centre of everything. Where there was Norbert, there was laughter. Anyone who had the faintest interest in sport in Kien knew and liked him. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Norbert Klopp was a stickler for appearances. He needed more time in the bathroom in the morning than us three women, Isolde smiles. He always looked his Sunday best. Jogging trousers were considered appropriate for sports, but not acceptable inside the house. And under no circumstances outside. One day, she recalls, Norbert drove one of his sons-in-law and a friend to see Jürgen play for Mainz 05. He wore a white shirt, a tie, a yellow V-neck jumper, a bit like the then German Foreign Secretary Hans Dietrich, Genscher. They stopped at a service station, and Norbert took the opportunity to lecture the critically underdressed state of his companions on the right attire for viewing a football game in Mainz. Even at carnival, a dress code was strictly enforced. The whole family would go as clowns, with Jürgen riding in a handcart as a toddler. Klopp Sr. ironed his own shirts and cut the kids' hair. His son's eyebrows formed a natural border below no strand of hair was allowed to fall. Stubble was also strictly verboten. Norbert, who dressed immaculately at all times, and Jürgen sometimes clashed about his casual outfits and sporty style, says Rath. One of the first things her brother did upon moving out of the house was to throw away the shaver and hairbrushes, old adds. It was hugely important for Norbert that the kids witnessed historical events, such as the moon landing or Muhammad Ali's fights. The family huddled around a small black-and-white television in the living room, fortified by tea and sandwiches. If one of the children fell asleep, Norbert would poke them in the side to wake them up again. Within a few years of coming to Glatten, Norbert Klopp had become one of its most important sportsmen. He played in SV Glatten's seniors football team until he was 40, while his children picked up empties on the touchline to earn a few pfennig. Coached the first team for a season and served as a board member. As his legs tired, his passion for playing tennis grew. Norbert was instrumental in setting up SV Glatten's tennis section and the building of a clay court. The club had initially hired a concrete court in an old quarry in Dornen after Klopp had paid the reluctant owner 50 Deutschmark to give the Glatteners access. In winter, he went skiing with Ulrich Ruth. Isolde was named after Ruth's sister. Every Saturday, in honour of father's return home, the house was tidied up. Little Jürgen, however, did his best to excuse himself from these chores, telling his older sisters that he had to study for school. In practice, he was lying comfortably in bed, his head buried in a book, Isolde says. His roguish ways reminded her of Emil E. Lönneberger, the blonde, blue-eyed prankster in Astrid Lindgren's children's book. A photo from his first day at school shows him with a bandaged knee. He'd run out of the house, traditional cone of candy in hand, and stumbled. "You see," his father gently admonished him, "if you hadn't run so fast, you wouldn't have a band-aid on the picture." On other occasions, he fell off his desk chair, lacerating an eyelid, and ran into a scooter, cutting his nose. Jürgen's birth was a huge moment for Norbert, says Ruth. He finally had a real sportsman to share his passion with. Pressure on the girls to excel in sports ceased almost immediately after Jürgen's arrival. They were allowed to devote their time to their own hobbies, like ballet and music. Elizabeth, a loving, even-tempered mum, who decided that the kids should become Protestants, like her, Norbert was Catholic, had a hard time fitting in all the children's activities.